Welcome, NeoGAF, to the Radio Free Nintendo podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
James Jones.
What?
And John Lindemann.
Extremely pleased to be here, Johnny.
Extremely pleased.
Yeah, me too.
Severely pleased.
Deep tissue pleasure in being here.
So, yes.
That was all you, James.
Welcome to all of our new listeners. Thanks to a wonderful official thread over at NeoGAF, a forum I've been a member of for over a decade, and I think this is one of the first threads actually devoted to anything from our website that I've ever seen there.
Yeah, we've been mentioned in there. I think RFN's been mentioned in there.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's pretty common for someone to post a thread that says, hey, what gaming podcast should I listen for? And then loyal fans, who I appreciate very much, will jump in there and say, you should try RFN. You probably never heard of it, but it's really good. And finally, this kind of groundswell of support came up in one of those threads. And Shaman, one of our loyal listeners and a longtime writer to our email segment, said, hey, I'm just going to start an official thread, which was fantastic. And it's apparently has brought in a lot of new people, a lot of people saying they've listened to the show for the first time. So I just want to say welcome, and I hope you like what you hear. And I also want to let our existing listeners know that this thread, which you can get a link to on our Facebook page, actually, facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo. The thread is actually a great resource even if you're already a listener, because it's actually a really funny write-up of who we are and our personalities and the sort of the history of the show and some stuff like that. And then there's also a great episode guide with links to all the retroactive episodes and then some of the special episodes, the anniversary shows that we've done, and descriptions of what's in those. So especially if you're a newer listener and you missed all that stuff the first time around, this is probably one of the better ways to find some of the most famous and most memorable episodes of the podcast. So it's actually a great resource for everybody, and I will probably avail myself of it at some point when I feel like going back and reliving those heady days. But anyway, we are going to jump right into the show this week, and for new business, we're actually going to start out with a little bit of a recap and just discuss some of the new announcements from the
newest business.
Yeah, the newest from the Nintendo Direct event that happened this week in all three major territories, actually. And the biggest news coming out of this, for sure, is that XSEED is going to publish The Last Story in North America. The day that I never thought would come, and I certainly didn't think Nintendo would ever publish it. And I guess I can take credit for that prediction, but, it is the kind of game that XSEED publishes, and I think it's a great fit for them. I'm just surprised Nintendo's letting them do it, and that's the part I never would have predicted, because they finally cracked.
It's a bit higher profile game than XSEED normally publishes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, their games tend to be a bit more niche than this one.
Yeah, this is something I would expect from Atlas or something like that.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing Ignition might have published when Shane Bettenhausen was there, but he's not anymore, and I don't know if they're going to continue. But yeah, it's fantastic. You know, I mean, I think for American gamers, and this is great because this is a game that I might have been less likely to import from Europe, especially because I'm still playing through Xenoblade and I'm still catching up on that. And, you know, I don't know as much about Last Story. From what I've seen so far, it seems a little less appealing to me than Xenoblade, but people, I mean, Danny Bivens in Japan loves it. It's like one of his favorite games. So it certainly is getting high praise. So I'm open to the idea, but the fact that it's coming to America makes it kind of an easier proposition. And, you know, XSEED is fairly experienced with you know, localizing these Japanese games, and I hope they're going to do a good job. I mean, this does seem like it's a cut above their usual production values, so.
Well, but I mean, they'll be doing very much what they did before with Scarlet Orobo, which is Nintendo of Europe has already localized the game for English.
Ah, yes.
And then they'll be using that, and maybe they'll make some changes for spelling conventions across the pond or whatever, but that's always been the chief sort of point of contention for people in terms of the idea of these games, you know, before we knew that Xenoblade even was coming, getting buried, was that, you know, the work's been done.
Right.
And if you're not willing to publish it, Nintendo, let someone else take the risk. And sure. That's why I think this is, you know, a very positive step. It's interesting because the most close sort of miss we had of this sort, I think, before was probably with Fatal Frame 4.
Right.
Yep.
Because there was a time, I seem to remember, after that had been out in Japan for several months, where Exceed were quoted as saying that they had heard that someone might be publishing that in America, but it wasn't going to be them, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like, maybe they had been involved in that, maybe they'd been looking into it, but someone else was going to get it, and of course it never did come out at all. And certainly Tecmo put that squarely on NOA.
Right.
They said that's their decision. They just chose to bury it completely rather than hand it off or do this sort of thing. So if you look at that experience, this definitely constitutes a policy shift. And I think that's what's going to make everyone sort of happy, is that, you know, they've done it two different ways. They've gone the sort of limited release route with Xenoblade, and they've done the sort of outsourcing kind of route with Exceed and the Last Story. But in each case, they've just done something where it's okay, well, we don't really want to put the full force of our publishing operation behind it, what we would normally do for marketing and all that kind of stuff, but we'll do enough to make it possible so that our fans can enjoy these games.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I think, what everybody was so angry about from the start, was the fact that no one could really understand why Nintendo wasn't doing this, because it was such a win-win for everybody involved. I mean, there was certainly some other company in the wings waiting to publish these games, and Nintendo was just sitting on them.
I think at the time, the thought was more on their ends of, well, they weren't sure if they wanted to commit to giving them up, I guess.
Yeah.
But this has kind of been the MO that Exceed has developed, which is this whole get-ins with publishers. So they spent a lot of time with Namco Bandai before they were given the reins to Soul Robo, which, if you remember, came out quite a bit later than it actually came out in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
It's my understanding they went through Namco Bandai to Nintendo of Europe to release the localized version of Soul Robo in the U.S. They sort of worked through the back channel to get that working. And then I guess they've established a good enough relationship with Nintendo now that they could approach them directly. That they had said a long time ago they wanted to do this game in Xenoblade. Like, that somebody asked them in their forum, like, yeah, we'd love to do it. They won't let us, but we'd love to. It's sort of this a mix of persistence and Nintendo recognizing that people want this game, and them feeling comfortable enough with the company that they're willing to let them do it.
And I think that is a big difference. If you go back to the Fatal Frame, which was years ago now.
Yep.
Fatal Frame, although there were plenty of vocal proponents of wanting that game to be released, maybe wanting it to be tweaked a little bit in the process, but
yeah,
people curious to try it and kind of annoyed that there was this mature-rated game from a venerable franchise on a Nintendo platform that Nintendo of America wasn't bringing over and wasn't letting anyone else bring over. The big difference is, I don't think there was a huge letter-writing campaign for Fatal Frame 4. I think Nintendo had their marketing research data that said, we're just not going to sell enough copies. And if these 20 people just scream their heads off, that's fine. They can go figure out a way to import it. But we're not releasing it for them. You know, and I think the difference with Xenoblade and The Last Story is Nintendo said, you know, maybe there's a middle ground between us releasing a game and spending a lot of money to launch it, which I know it seems like they haven't always done. Like, if you look at Excitebots, I think their marketing budget for Excitebots was spent on putting wheels in the box. And I think that they thought that was a successful strategy. They said, people love the wheel. So if we stick a wheel in the box and put it on the front of the shelf, then we don't have to run commercials for it. We don't have to let anybody know it's coming out. We don't have to do PR events for advanced publicity. And it was a miserable failure. But there, for Nintendo of America to release a game through all their distribution channels and to give it their standard sort of minimum level of marketing, it costs a certain amount of money. And I think they traded off with what they expected Xenoblade and Last Story to sell and said, the equation just doesn't make sense. And then you got Operation Rainfall. You got this huge cry from the fan base. I mean, not just a really loud cry from a small number of people, but a cry for these games from a very large number of people. And it let Nintendo realized that maybe their marketing data was a little bit off, or that there were people who were really committed and wanted to buy these games, even if it's not enough to call for the full treatment that they normally give. And so they found ways. This is the new Nintendo of America. I think they're a little bit more agile than they used to be. And so, hey, I think it's wonderful. Sounds like there's not much XSEED could do to screw it up, really, if they're just taking a kind of finished product from Nintendo Europe. And
yeah, I mean, that is, again, that is the big difference between now and Fatal Frame. Right. You have a ready-made localization from Nintendo of Europe, which, I mean, there are indications that Nintendo of Europe toyed with the idea of doing Fatal Frame 4.
Yeah.
And to be fair, you know, it's not really something that Nintendo of America has ever been put in the position of before. It's like, well, we passed on something, but then right. somebody else has kind of done it, and then it kind of comes back around. Because the other part of it is you do have to have that popular kind of sentiment that you had with Operation Rainfall, because you see in, you know, a number of other cases where Nintendo of Europe did go to the effort of localizing it, if it was something like Last Window, the sequel to Hotel Dusk, for DS, or another Code R, the sequel to another Code, but that was actually a Wii instead of DS.
Trace Memory. It's the Trace Memory game for Wii.
Yeah, as it's known in the States, Trace Memory. In both of those cases, Nintendo of Europe did the same thing. They produced a localization that Nintendo of America declined to do, but you did not Tingle. See that come back around. Yeah, and Tingle as well. All of these cases.
And Disaster, but that's not much of a localization.
The point is that in those cases, you had the ready-made localization, but not the popular support. So it seems that you had to have both in order for Nintendo of America to take these very sort of unusual steps. But now that, you know, they've done them, maybe they can see which kind of works better in terms of the sort of limited release strategy or the giving it to another publisher strategy. It could be instructive for them in future cases, should they arise.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what's sad for me is I would like to have bought an XSEED version of the game, because I actually respect them as a company, even if they bring over...
Can't you cancel your order? I mean...
Well, no. So here's the funny thing. It shipped the day before
the news came out.
Yeah, because as we record, as we record, we've just hit the official release date of Last Story in Europe. But, you know, if you've got a pre-order with an online store, typically they'll ship a couple of days early, such that if you live in the UK, the copy will hit your doormat on launch day. Yeah. Now, of course, it's going to take longer that to reach James, but it would go a few days early, so the timing just wasn't quite. I'm sure it's no coincidence as well that they wanted to get this announcement before the release, so that the two sort of reinforced each other in a positive way in the PR game.
Right. It's probably coming from Guernsey again, like everything else I've ordered from that website.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. I hope the game is great. James, you'll be telling us about that probably in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
So we can look forward to that. I'm excited for XSEED. I'm really happy that they're doing this. I hope it's a great success for them so they can localize Game Center CX2 in the future with the money they make from this. And
self-serving.
I really want to congratulate Operation Rainfall for a lot of hard work that they put in, and all the people who got involved with that effort too. I mean, it's a communal effort, so it was a lot of people getting involved and voicing their opinions and writing letters the old-fashioned way, which is clearly. You know, I think it's pretty clear this has an effect, and I seriously doubt any of this would have happened if that had not taken place. I mean, I think it's a combination of Operation Rainfall and maybe some media scrutiny too, but I think the media attention alone would not have done it, because you can see in the past it didn't work the previous times that this stuff happened.
Right.
So I think getting the fans involved directly and they handled themselves in a very professional way that didn't involve spamming, it didn't involve online petitions, it didn't involve a bunch of stuff that is just really counteractive to their goals. And they did it in a very intelligent way, and it seems to have worked. But anyway, I do feel like I do kind of still stand by my prediction that this game is not going to do very well in terms of sales. But, you know, XSEED, I don't think any of their games do great, but I think they set their expectations low enough and they keep their costs low enough. They obviously stay in business somehow. Relative to their normal releases, it'll probably be a big hit. I think compared to a normal Nintendo release, it's going to be a huge flop. But that doesn't mean it can't be successful financially. And I think, for the people who want to buy the game and play it, it's going to be wonderful. But I do feel bad because, by all accounts, it's a great game. It is coming out probably around the same time as Wii U, maybe a little bit before, and I just get this Baten Kaitos Origins feel from it.
Oh, it's gonna, don't go there.
It's
going to
be a cool game that people will really like, and nobody's going to play it, nobody's going to buy it, and it's just really going to be
sad.
I just think that's just the condition. You know, it's because it's taken this long to localize. It took this long for the game to come out, period. And because there's been this fairly anemic release schedule leading up to it, I think most of the people who, a lot of the less informed fans who might be interested in a Japanese RPG on any system, just won't be interested in Wii games by that point. They won't even be paying attention. I mean, I think a lot of them have already moved on. So
that's the thing. It would have sold because there was nothing else out there, but by the time it comes out, Wii U will be out there, so therefore...
I don't know. There's some space. I mean, it depends, obviously, on when Wii U's coming out. But, you know, if we assume it's coming out around November, seems pretty safe, then obviously you've got Xenoblade in April... Don't really want to put it too close to that.
No, but you could drop it in July or somewhere like there.
The summer. Yeah. So I think it has some breathing space there. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's a limited scope for how well it can do. But I'm sure XSEED have gone into this with their eyes wide open.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they do, like Johnny said, they do the niche games already. I mean, I doubt they went to Nintendo going, we're going to negotiate, we're going to sell a million copies of this.
Yeah, they're like Atlus used to be. I mean, Atlus has actually become kind of a large company now. I mean, Catherine sold over a million copies, so Atlus has found themselves kind of against all odds becoming sort of a medium-sized publisher, and I think XSEED is now filling the kind of really small publisher gap that they used to, which is great. We need those people to bring those games over. Okay, so another one of the big stories, really one of the few game announcements, was for Mario Tennis Open. Now, this is a game we knew existed, but we really didn't know anything else about it.
It's just Mario Tennis, basically.
It's Mario Tennis for 3DS.
Is it, though? Because do we know about any RPG mode?
Well, that's the part I was going to ask. Not that I'm aware of. I haven't heard that yet.
But... No, there's no indications of that yet. Obviously, it looks a hell of a lot like the GameCube Mario Power Tennis, which, of course, that did not have an RPG mode, whereas its portable cousins did.
Right.
So it's difficult to say whether it's, you know, just taking that and going to add stuff, or whether it's pretty much just a, you know, 3D port of that with some touchscreen shortcuts in there. They've got some gyro control. They've got online play.
Right.
That's what we do know that's in there.
Well, the online will be great, but I really do think having a more robust single player mode, whether it's this RPG thing or something else, but to me that is really good to have on a portable system more than a console where you're going to have everybody gather around the TV like we used to with Mario Tennis on N64. And the thing is that if it's really like the GameCube version, that was already remade once for Wii.
Yeah.
So I'm not interested in a 3DS remake of Mario Power Tennis, which I don't think was that great to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it looks a lot like it is one thing.
Well, and that's natural, but I really do want it to be an original game with new features, and I think there's value in, you know, in gearing it more towards a handheld experience in which you might not be playing multiplayer as often.
So Camelot is the developer, though, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
They've developed all of them since Virtual Boy, so...
Well, but the one thing I would say about it is you look at this, obviously we became aware of this game's existence 2 Nintendo Directs ago, was it?
Yes. It was not quite so direct, to be honest.
Yeah, when it was the event where they had the whole Monster Hunter Tri-G/4 thing and all that, and it was just a video in there. But we haven't really known about it for very long, and yet it has a release date. Now, contrast that with, we still don't have a release date for Luigi's Mansion 2, still don't have a release date for Animal Crossing,
nope.
Paper Mario,
nope.
You know, titles which we've known about for, in Luigi's Mansion's case, only a few months longer, but in the others, significantly longer than that. You do wonder whether this has been brought along a bit quickly, you know, fast-tracked to fill a gap in the release schedule that came about because perhaps some of these other projects have ended up being a bit longer than they'd previously thought.
Or some of those other ones that got moved up to fill the earlier gaps.
If this Mario Tennis game is something that's been sped along, it may not necessarily be all that compatible with having a really robust feature set and lots of single-player stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, it wouldn't. And that would be a real shame, because I don't think there's any reason to just force this game out immediately just to get in there if you can make a game that will have long-term viability.
Yeah, just the, I don't think a rushed arcade-style sports game makes sense a year after 3DS comes out. I mean, if for the launch title Madden game, maybe you can kind of understand that it doesn't have a franchise mode. But, you know, a year later, I feel like, I mean, tennis is a simple enough game in the first place that if it is just tennis, I mean, online is great. And, you know, if I had the game, I would play some online. But Mario Tennis alone is a pretty shallow experience if you're not playing with other people in the room.
It does have the one good thing is it does have the download play in there that seems like it's pretty full featured. So don't, you know, that does make it significantly more likely that you might be able to get some local multiplayer just by knowing someone with a 3DS rather than 3DS and the game. Because as you say, but that's always going to be a big part of this kind of, you know, wacky sports game is the fun of someone in the same room. So they're trying to sort of make it as inclusive as possible with the download play, but at the same time, it's not the same as actually, you know, playing in front of the big screen with the console games that you've had in the past on N64 and GameCube. So the need for something else still stands.
Well, the good news is this one should at least have Waluigi.
There you go.
Yep.
Now
huge.
He was introduced in the N64 Mario Tennis.
I'm all about the Waluigi.
Oh, I love him. And especially in the tennis game, he's awesome too. I mean, Waluigi up on the net in your face. That is the way to play Mario Tennis. So I'm looking forward to it. I was really sad he wasn't in Mario Kart. And I'm still sad he hasn't been in any Smash Brothers games. I'm hoping the new one's going to change that. But I really like Waluigi. I think he's very funny.
Well, Sakurai tweeted that he's working on the Smash Bros. Games, like, for real now.
He should be.
Like, I haven't been doing anything before this. We just started working.
They've still been doing Kid Icarus or something, but now that that's, you know, we're a few weeks away from that coming out, I think we can assume that they've been wrapped up on that.
I actually really enjoyed watching the European Nintendo Direct, which is just the Japanese one with subtitles versus...
Yeah, this is the growing trend of Nintendo of Europe's adherence to NCL, that our Nintendo Direct was not a 11-minute video with the sub-European equivalent to Reggie saying something. It was just the Japanese video with subtitles. And anything from a higher-rated game than a 12 being edited out.
Yes.
Really?
Because the thing is, if you have any kind of video content, you've got to stick a Peggy rating on the front of it, so I guess they didn't want to stick like a 16 on the front of it, because there was actually video in the Japanese version showing that Fatal Frame 2 or Project Zero 2 Wii remake that's coming out in Japan in June. And when, of course, that got cut out of the European releases, I guess that's not coming to Europe. But in fact, Nintendo of Europe's new Twitter account followed up quite shortly by saying it in fact is coming to Europe.
We just couldn't put it in the video.
We just couldn't put in that video, presumably for ratings reasons. So that actually is the photo spoke last week about the desolation of the European Wii schedule after Pandora's Tale. Well, this will be one game after it. That's one.
Imagine those two being the final two Nintendo games for the system. That is fucked. Now, what's even funnier about it, though, is anytime they announce something for Japan, they would put the little notice on there that a European announcement will come at a later date or something along those lines.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially stuff that was newly announced for Japan, but there was the fact that Fire Emblem said this is coming out in Europe in 2012.
Yes.
That was news. And, of course, the fact that it's coming out in Europe, that is a good indicator that it could come out in America, perhaps because NOA is localizing it, or perhaps even by the sort of circuitous back channel that we're seeing established now with Last Story. But, you know, that's a good sign. And I was quite interested to see the CG cel-shaded cutscene style that they had on show.
It's a little bit different.
Different look than you used to see, I'm used to seeing Fire Emblem anyway, but look quite nice.
Well, now what's beyond that though, when as I was watching the Iwata one, I really enjoyed that fact that Iwata goes, yes, I got to play the final version of Kid Icarus just last week. I'm like, oh god, that is not a good sign.
He's a busy man, okay?
That's probably not a strong showing for this game.
So, Greg, didn't you have some other notes about the European releases? Or
because at the same time, Nintendo of Europe decided to put out their kind of what's usually kind of quarterly release schedule. Mm-hmm. It wasn't strictly for the next quarter, but there was a number of things that were quite interesting. First of all, a little bit off the beaten track, but this is important for me, Nano Assault has a window now.
Excellent.
For April.
A European developed game.
And, yes.
And I stand by, one of the best games on 3DS.
There is a silver lining, apparently, because it's also coming out in Japan and Europe at a later date than America, obviously, where it came out a few months ago. And apparently they have improved the frame rate somewhat.
Hmm. Sweet, sweet.
Didn't really see that as a problem, but okay.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that particularly either, but there you go. And also they've included an invert option for controls, which
nice.
Is good because
yeah.
I am an invert person.
Yeah, I would have liked that.
So that's very nice for me. And then you've got Rhythm Thief got a date, which is a game we've been following here. And not only did it get a date the 5th of April this year, but in fact, this is one of those games. And this is kind of a prediction that James made on the prediction show, although I'm not sure whether he meant it specifically for Europe, where it was eminently more predictable. But Rhythm Thief is going to get distributed by Nintendo while being published by Sega, much in the same vein as we've seen with Capcom and Resident Evil and Tecmo and DOA, etc. But it's nice to see that this is a very promising game. He's going to be getting, you know, a bit of a push the boat out kind of treatment from Nintendo on 3DS. I like that. And then also another shining note is, I'm not sure if we really knew about this much before, but Art of Balance Touch for the eShop. Now, Art of Balance was a WiiWare game. You might remember Carl was a big fan of this. It got very good reviews as well. It was quite acclaimed, and so this is going to be some sort of portable version and presumably will feature touchscreen interface from the title, so that's pretty promising. And another thing that's coming over from Japan at some point in the second quarter, actually, is a Picross eShop game. Now, you may remember that there are, in fact, two of these already out in the eShop in Japan, but for some reason, we've been all lagging behind. But supposedly, in quarter two, coming up in Europe, we will get the first of those anyway. So, I mean, obviously, I'm a big Picross person. This is the old 2D Picross.
But is it an original eShop version? It's not like a Mario's Picross for Game Boy?
No, this will be, this is actually called in Japan Picross E, you know, because the eShop, you know, it is, okay. It is a new piece of software, obviously.
They can't exactly call it Picross 3D.
No, they can't.
They're out of ideas.
I would like a Picross 3D 2, like where it's actually in stereoscopic on the 3DS. I think that would be a nice artificial bonus for that game. And I would just love to have more Picross 3D, quite frankly. So that game, I think,
absolutely,
did pretty well in terms of sales and especially in word of mouth. So I would not be surprised to see more Picross 3D at some point in the future.
Maybe Picross 3DE. Yeah?
3DE. Okie doke. So why don't we kick off new business proper with the games we've been playing. And John, you're up first.
Proper. Yeah, I'm continuing my crusade through the bucket list / backlog. Start off with Super Mario Bros. 3. Which is, I'm kind of ranking my backlog in order of how embarrassed I am that I haven't, you know, beaten / opened some of these games that I have sitting around my house. So Super Mario 3 is definitely right at the top of the list. It was probably second after Chrono Trigger. And yeah, so I pretty much suck at Super Mario Bros. 3. I'm really not a good player.
You said you had played it before, but you just never beaten it.
Oh, yeah. I've never beaten it. So, you know, I've just played it very briefly off and on. So this time, this is it. It's going to happen. So I think I'm on the third world now. You know, I had a saved game on there from forever ago that was on World 2. And
so is this just Wii Virtual Console suspend?
You got it.
Long-term suspend.
Yeah, it's my savior, by the way, because I'm nice. So awful at it. But
it's nice.
But yeah, you know, I've been trying to pinpoint exactly what kind of didn't grab me about this game. I don't think I'm really a fan of the art style, really. It just seems kind of like all the colors are really washed out. But, you know, I'm struggling through it. I think I just, you know, like I've lost all talent at Twitch games, or maybe just, you know, Super Mario 3 just makes me feel that way.
It's just, you know, it comes up to a jump or an enemy and it's like, how do I shoot? I don't understand. What do I do?
Why is he not covered in muscles?
Why aren't I walking forward through a 3D environment? I just don't understand it.
If you have a Hammer Brothers suit, you can shoot hammers.
Or fireballs, but, you know, what happens when you go shrink back down? Then he's
lost.
Right. He doesn't know how to interact with the game
anymore. Well,
that's
what always
anymore.
Happens to me. I always just do something stupid, and I, you know, I lose whatever power I happen to have.
You know, to be fair, I do feel like Mario 3 is one of those games that is actually harder than you remember, because most of us have been playing it for so long and we've played through it so many times, a lot of it's muscle memory. And if you do go back to it after a really long time, or if you watch someone try to play it who's never actually played it or is just not as familiar with it, what you see is that the game, especially, you know, the levels are very short and they tend to be fairly dense with enemies, with blocks, with just things to do. And some of those levels are tough. I mean, I feel like the level with the sun, where the sun chases after you.
Yeah, that's a bitch.
I can do almost with my eyes closed, because you kind of have to learn to do it that way to get through it. If you, if you try to play through that slowly and meticulously and just react to the sun, it is very, very hard to do. And the best way to play that level is just to blast through it and never stop and just jump at exactly the right times and just blast through the whole stage in 30 seconds. If you can do that, it's easy. But if you can't do that, it's really hard. And there's a lot of stuff like that in Mario 3.
Well, what I find, like I said, when I lose the powers, I find that, you know, things are fairly easy when I have the fire flower or something like that. If I have something, you know, in my bag that I can use to power up before I go into an area. But I find if I lose that stuff, I'm screwed. And it takes me so long to try to get that stuff back. Like, I feel like there's a lot of techniques that I haven't really figured out yet. Like, I haven't figured out, you know, the proper way to grind for items when I need them, so that I have a, you know, a big stockpile of them that I can just bring out whenever I want. And I feel like I haven't really learned how to use the suits properly. It's so foreign to me. As a Mario game, it seems so strange that a Mario game is so foreign to me,
it's
but it
so
is.
It's so unlike all the other hundreds of Super Mario games that you've played.
Thousands of 3D Mario games.
It is. I mean, there's no doubt they made Super Mario World significantly easier.
Yes.
Because you get to hold items in reserve that you can actually deploy during the level.
Well, yeah, and Yoshi.
You get Yoshi at times. Just the focus was more on exploration, on alternate exits, and all that kind of stuff. You know, probably a bit slower paced, and obviously the the flying was in there again, but I think it was probably a bit more useful. But yeah, I mean, it's a bit tougher. It's a bit more sort of old school. But I mean, if you played the I still don't know whether it's a huge step up over like the original Super Mario Brothers in terms of difficulty. But it's certainly a lot more varied. I mean, the one thing the thing with the original Super Mario Brothers, it's tough, but it's got a pretty thin playbook with which it tests you.
Yeah, and it also has a very small range of enemy creatures as well. I mean, there's only a handful of attacks that you actually have to learn to counteract or watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like in Super Mario 3, that's much more varied. The enemies, it's harder to predict the way they attack at you, like the pyramid areas where in World 2, where, you know, you have the little guys that look like the blocks, but then they jump up.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I love those.
Yeah, you'll have guys jumping up and, like, kind of crossing over, so you have to sit back and let them do their thing, and then... You know, sometimes, like, the easiest thing to do is to hop up on them from on top, like, almost anticipate that they're going to jump, and as they jump, meet them in midair, and sometimes you screw that up, and so...
And again, that's a stage a lot of us just kind of know where those guys are, so you set yourself up on a trajectory so that you will already come down on top of them, or you'll just skip them. But if you don't know where they are, I mean, if they're really working the way they're supposed to, where they really are decoys, and they're in disguise, and you don't know what's coming... Those guys can really mess you up. They can pop out at you while you're in the middle of a jump and can't necessarily get away.
Yeah.
So it really is a tough game. It's hard for us to believe if you grew up with the game and played it a lot, but it's a pretty difficult game.
I didn't grow up with it. I played it for the first time on a virtual console. I think
is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I spoke about it on the show a very long time ago now.
Yeah.
I was in the same position, and it is fairly challenging. I agree with what Johnny said in the past. It spikes towards the end.
Oh, the World 6, the Ice World, I think is very hard. World 7 has some tough platforming, but it's not necessarily going to kill you. It can be frustrating. You might have to redo a lot of places if you miss a jump. But World 6 is just full of really nasty enemies and a lot of pits that you will slide right into.
But at the point, it's going to take a different kind of perseverance than with Chrono Trigger, John. I hope you're ready for this.
I know. Yeah, there's already been a couple times where I'm just like, oh, God. If I can just make it through. Well, and the hard thing for me is I'll make it all the way through, because bear in mind, I don't really know any areas of this game whatsoever. So I'll make it all the way through and make it all the way almost to the end, and then die and lose all my lives, and I'll have to go all the way back and start and go all the way through again.
Rough. But at the very least, you should figure out where the warp whistles are so that, you know, you can always jump back to kind of where you left off.
Mm-hmm. BJ has a warp whistle.
Flesh colored.
Yes.
So, John, what else you got this week?
Yeah, the other game that I've had years of experience with yet have never played is Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, which I finally said.
Oh, that just came out of recent. Oh, no.
This time
wait.
It's going to happen. Wait,
well, there was the 5-year anniversary edition that did come out quite recently. Did you get that, John?
You got that one for the PS3 just to complete the set.
Yeah, so it's been very interesting because, you know, there's various reasons why I haven't gotten into this series. I actually forgot that I actually owned this on PS3 at one point.
What?
I bought it. I actually owned this on PS3 at one point, sold it on eBay because I didn't think that they were going to come out with the, with like Knights of the Nine and the other packs for it because they were kind of hedging on that. So I was like, well, I want the full experience.
You don't want any of the experience.
Yeah. So I want the full experience and I have to play this game now. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to just sell the PS3 version. Later on, I got the PC version of the Game of the Year. That just never really gelled with me. You know, the controls, at that point, I was kind of a PC gaming neophyte, and I just really didn't know. It just didn't feel comfortable to me. I was much more used to console games back then. And so eventually, I don't even remember when I bought the 360 one. I don't know. Just at some point, I think I saw it for $20 and just grabbed it.
I love that you've owned this on 3 different platforms and never played
it. I said, if I don't play this on 360, I'm never going to play it ever. So I said, I'm going to have it, and I'm just going to tuck it away in the vault, and at some point, I will promise myself that I will play it. So this time, the time has come.
Yeah, Neil spied that you were playing it on Xbox Live, and he teased it in the gaff thread, and people were getting kind of excited about it, so...
Yeah, I saw, I got a kick out of that. It was like, you know, the fact that I'm playing it as an event on NeoGAF of some sort.
Yeah. So how shitty does this game look now?
It still looks pretty good.
It's at kind of a 360 launch window game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a credit to what they did with it. I think it still looks pretty good. The one constant, and I said this, I asked you about Skyrim, the character models look terrible. Yeah. They are horrible, but then again, I mean, they've always kind of been horrible throughout this game series.
They've gotten a lot better in Skyrim.
Yeah, I hope so, because, man, whew, yeah. They are ugly in Oblivion. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of the reasons why I never really got into it, I think all the times I've tried to play it, is I always felt like it was an obstacle trying to figure out how you could build your character such that you wouldn't wind up kind of screwing yourself over near the end, because what you can do is the skills that you upgrade are the skills that you use. So literally, if you want to upgrade your acrobatics, you do that by jumping, literally jumping in the game. So if you want to sit there, and because, you know, they have a large modding community and they figured out all of these numbers, but if you sit there, you could take your acrobatics skill up to 100 by jumping 34,000 times in a row.
Oh, there's got to be a better way.
Oh, absolutely. And that's
so
not the way.
You're saying I could build an Erector Set robot to level up my character?
Absolutely.
Shit, I need to do that, because for me, that would be the best game ever.
This is one of the fatal flaws of this game to me, is that it lends itself to grinding. So what I did was I did some research and figured out, okay, well, I want my character to actually, you know, really not have a problem going through the game. So I'm kind of doing a technique where you grind a little bit, and there's a whole bunch of tricks that you can do to kind of train yourself. And, you know, so as you go through the game, you can kind of optimally upgrade all of your stats. But it's silly. I mean, in terms of just playing through the game, it's pretty sad that I'm sitting here saying, okay, I can actually screw myself if I don't. Like, I think it's endurance that gives you more health. So it's in your best interests to make sure your endurance is really high as early as possible. However, you don't have to touch it at all. So the problem with that is, everything else in the game, if you're a level 10 character, well, all the other monsters in the world are also level 10 characters.
Right.
So you could actually be at 10, and you could have the health of somebody that would be level 4. So you're fighting monsters that kick your ass because you only have level 4 health.
Because you've been jumping for the last 9 levels.
Exactly. Just because you haven't been sitting there grinding out your endurance stat.
Yeah, and that has been improved in Skyrim, because now your health is no longer a normal stat. It's more like Paper Mario series or Mario and Luigi, where when you get a level up, you can assign points to different things or something like that. You can choose perks, but you can always get a bonus to either your magic, your health, or your stamina.
Yeah, well, I'm doing it, you know, this plays to a little bit of OCD that I have with just, like, you know, being a completionist with my characters, wanting to max them out and everything. So I can't say that I'm not enjoying it. I am absolutely enjoying the game. But, you know, I find it's just kind of annoying that I'm like, okay, well, the game isn't going to help me do it right, so I have to ensure that it's done right in my mind.
Hmm.
But that said, I can completely see why people love the game, because the world that they create is fascinating to play through.
Or jump through.
And to me, it's like one of the only true sandbox games out there, and the fact that it's just fun to walk around and just do stuff just to see what happens.
Yeah.
Like, what happens if I steal this? Because you can just grab anything, pick anything up, walk in anywhere.
You can kill anybody in the game. You can walk up to the king who's giving you quests and who you're basically supposed to serve for the main adventure, and you could just kill him.
Yeah, and well, you know, it was interesting thinking about what we talked about last week about consequence in games and how, you know, feeling like what you do doesn't really matter or doesn't really have any impact. And that's one of the things I like is that, for example, if you get caught and thrown in jail, you have choices of, you know, say if you kill somebody and a guard sees you and the guard says, hey, you know, we've been looking for you, we're going to take you to jail. You can either pay the guard off, or you can fight the guard, run away, or you can accept being taken to jail. However, you will lose 1 point off of a random stat.
Oh, really?
Which is incredibly annoying, and it's permanent. You can't do anything about it.
Hmm.
So I find it's interesting that, hey, you want to do anything you want? Absolutely go ahead and do that. But you know what? You are going to be permanently penalized in a way that is meaningful. And I think that's really cool. Because that means that gives, like, you know, that gives my actions weight within the game world.
So you're going to keep playing Oblivion?
Absolutely. Yep.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm glad you finally went back to it. So, Greg, why don't you pick up on new business?
So, last week, I played Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, for a couple of hours on launch day, basically. But it wasn't long after that, in terms of game time, that I actually got to the final level, beat the last boss and all, and I enjoyed that. But there was still a lot of stuff to do, because sort of as I'd anticipated, what happens at the end of the game is it tots up all your money and gives you a sort of residence for Wario that's commensurate with how much money you accumulated. And what I had was a tree house at that point.
Oh, God!
Mainly because I did not have many of the treasures. You know, I just kind of burned through. But I decided, right, time to go back through the levels and have a look where we can find them. And what happens is that they actually, the levels that have a treasure left to be found, start flashing. And the other thing is, you'll see some areas of the map that are flashing that don't have a level on them. And that's because you get there from an alternate exit to a level you've already beaten first. So, yeah, I was kind of having to go back through sort of two sets of levels to improve the situation. And again, much like Super Mario World, you know, the levels with alternate exits are marked, although not by colour in this case, naturally, by concentric circles. But yeah, you know, I think I'd had cleared one alternate exit in my original sort of playthrough to the end, and the level that it led to was a kind of trivial, almost bonus stagey kind of thing. So I wasn't sure how, you know, significant that was going to be as a component of the game. But certainly, now that I've cleared all of them, there are some that are significantly more difficult to find. Most of them aren't too difficult, especially because you're looking for it very purposefully, because you know there's one around here somewhere. And some of them have some pretty blatant hints, like an arrow made out of coins pointing into the sky. Yeah. But others, you know, do involve kind of you're going off the screen a little bit, you know, maybe a little sort of trick with the visuals where you could just sort of walk into a kind of black expanse and find that there's something on the other side. Or kind of, you know, that is something I always love to go back to Super Mario World. Is finding those secrets like that.
There's a lot of that in Shake It, too. Tons of secret exits and bonus levels. And the bonus levels in Shake It are some of the best levels, too.
Yeah, the bonus levels are really where they take it up a notch, isn't it? And I mean, with this, one of the secret exits leads to a completely separate kind of world, you know, it's split up into different worlds on this island, you know, and one of them then leads to, I think, was it Sherbet Island or something, which is, you know, and this has got some of the more challenging levels in the game, which you don't have to play at all to get to the end, because I didn't. But, you know, once I'd found it, I was playing it, you know, and there's like some really slippery platforms that could catch you out. You know, I mean, obviously Wario, the way he controls, he's so heavy, he's not slippery at all like Mario is, so you get really used to that sure-footedness, and then this level just completely kind of upends that. You've got to be careful, and there's some tricky secrets to find, all that kind of stuff. And some of these treasures, as I said last week, you know, you've got to carry the key to the lock to get them, but they start spacing them out a lot more, so you're kind of carrying this key for quite a while, and while you're carrying the key, you can't do any other actions, like, you know, charge, your signature kind of charge attack, or if you've got a different hat, you know, you'd have to kind of put the key down first, or this or the other. So there's a, yeah, there's a puzzle element to it. Some cases, you know, very light, especially compared to what came next in the series, but still something a bit more interesting. And so you're playing through all these extra levels and the secrets and the exits and all that, until finally I could go back to the final boss, beat him, and actually get Wario's castle back for him. It was really enjoyable. It was a kind of a very significant kind of second half to the game.
Well, it sounds wonderful. I'm sure it'll be coming out in America within the next week or two. And I just think it's a shame that we never got that planned Game Boy Advance remake. Super Mario Advance 5, Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3.
Stop. No more numbers. No more names.
Panel Edition Tridux.
That's it. We're done here.
I do have a new game. This is an interesting one. Much like on a previous occasion where a failed attempt to get Chibi Robo on eBay led to me getting Chosoju Mecha MG, in this case, my very sobering look into the world of auctions for Ninja 5-0 ended up sort of indirectly getting me to a game that I've had my own for a very long time, but had not been able to get around to for the DS. So this is Sliver Link, from the Hudson puzzle series that used to come out in Japan. I think there was about a year from 2006, 2007, where they released 15 of these or something. They were very prolific, you know, and each one was something like, you know, crosswords or various types of logic puzzles or this, you know, for the DS, because obviously, you know, that was the big craze, especially in Japan. Brain teasers, brain training and all that, and Hudson were very big on it. But this particular one, Slitherlink, I'm not going to say legendary, because that's definitely overstating it, but it had a very positive reputation that it managed to garner in a few places. Like, there was a magazine that I read, and a Eurogamer reviewed it and gave it a 10. They just found it completely addictive. And so the thing about it is it's basically very similar to Picross in many ways. And so I'm a big Picross guy. And at the point that I did this, I didn't know that Picross E was coming out in the eShop like next month or whenever it's going to be. But, you know, I thought, I've got a Picross type of itch that could use scratching. So when I saw a copy available on eBay for a reasonable price, I went for it. And so what you're doing in this is actually you've got a grid, and it'll have a certain amount of numbers on it that are telling you basically how to draw a line in such a way, using the edges of the grid around all the numbers or alongside all the numbers, such that, you know, if you've got a grid space with a 2 in it, 2 edges are filled in by this loop that you're drawing. So you've just got to, again, much like Picross, solve it algorithmically. You start off by, you know, eliminating what you can eliminate and filling in what you definitely can fill in, and you go from there. You know, it's exactly the same kind of process. I think it isn't, at least so far from what I've played, as necessarily quite as intrinsically satisfying. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about last week. You know, there isn't that kind of illusion or, you know, added pleasure of like, oh, I'm drawing a picture or I'm sort of fashioning a sculpture with the 3D one, you know, because it is just drawing lines on a grid. It does feel a bit more abstract and sort of...
It doesn't form anything, essentially.
It doesn't quite hit that place in your brain that's looking for satisfaction in quite the same way, at least not yet. But at the same time, I think it's a big benefit for me in the sense that, you know, I played a hell of a lot of Picross DS. Obviously, I played the 3D one. You know, I do kind of... I know the routine a bit with that. And even though this is the much the same kind of task, it's still a process that I'm going through now of, you know, how to... each time I'm coming back to puzzles and they're increasing in complexity and size, you know, the grids get bigger and bigger. You start off with like 6x6, and then there's ones I've seen in like 24x30. So it's a huge increase in how complex it is. And unlike, say, 3D Picross, it won't tell you when you make a mistake.
Oh.
So one mistake can then perpetuate into many, many, many mistakes and completely fuck it up. So, you know, you've got to be careful and all that. You know, it's that kind of puzzle solving. But starting to identify, like, okay, well, I see, you know, you see a couple of threes next to a two, straight away I'm thinking, right, I know what's in play and what isn't. You know, you're more quickly, you know, shorthand kind of identifying what can be filled in and what can't be straight off the bat, rather than kind of leading up to it absolutely step by step. step. That process, that kind of learning all these little sort of tricks, even though there aren't any real tricks, it's pure logic, but, you know, these sort of mental shortcuts that you can make. I've already done all that in Picross, you know. I'm eager to play more Picross when they release more on the eShop, but it won't be the same. This has got that kind of discovery to it, so I've been enjoying it a lot. It definitely is addictive, as was promised by some of those reviews, and it's the kind of thing that shows up in newspapers or puzzle books or that, and it could well be a 3DS version or something one day, I don't doubt. But
not from Hudson.
Not from us, no, they are kaput. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this package is pretty cool because it does, much like Picross 3D to some extent, you know, there's a star system. How quickly you solve it will determine how many stars you get, and that unlocks extra puzzles and all that. And the interface is good and all that. So, I mean, they've wrapped it up very nicely. I'm very pleased with the way it's presented here. But, I mean, if this is the kind of puzzle game that you like, keep an eye out for something like Slitherly. It's, oh, my God, knows how many other names, like Fences and Loop the Loop. And, you know, it's not something that seems to have a consistent naming convention quite the way that Picross does. But keep your eye out, because it's very, very satisfying if your brain kind of likes that problem munching, if you like.
Sure. Okay, well, I will go next. And last weekend, I had a long weekend and said, damn it, I'm in the middle of too many games right now. I'm going to finish some of these. So I finished 3 games in one weekend. First off, I finally wrapped up Mario Galaxy 2. I got my 120 stars. There was a period, the kind of the 100 through 110 were some of the really painful ones, like playing the minigame type levels and the flying level, trying to beat the bird on the flying level was just horrible. I powered through it though. The last few were more enjoyable for the most part. There were some purple coin challenges that are generally more fun because they kind of make you explore the level more and play it well, but also play it fast. So I enjoyed those. There was a speed run on the boss rush that I felt was horrible.
Yeah, oh, I remember that.
Just
yeah.
Really, that is sinister.
Not fun to do. Just really should not be in the game. And ultimately, I mean, I think that's my problem, because I think probably about 100 stars in that game are really fun, and about 20 are just infuriating. And ultimately, there were just, you know, some of these levels I felt like I played more than I wanted to because I kept having to retry. And so I was kind of excited to try the green star playthrough. Ended up getting only one of them in the very first level. Just kind of, oh, okay, there it is. It's hidden. It's kind of off camera. You can barely see it. Neat. And it was at that point I realized, okay, I would have liked this if it had come about 60 stars earlier. But the problem is I'd already played too much Galaxy 2. And the other problem is that the 120 green stars that awaited me in the bonus adventure, or whatever you want to call it, the second quest, the problem is they're in the same levels I'm already kind of sick of, because you made me get 120 to begin with. So if they were in new levels, or if this was more mixed in with the initial set rather than all be shoved at the end, I would have probably done a lot more of it. But as it is, I ended at 121, and I think I'm just going to let it sit right there forever.
Mm.
The other reason I wanted to at least get the 120 is because there were a couple levels at the end of the special world that I had not seen yet. Unfortunately, some of them were rehashes from, you know, the boss rush I really could have done without. I didn't find that appealing at all. But there's the level where you play through Thwomp's Fortress from 64, and that's yes. Awesome. I mean, I love that. I love doing that. I was sad that they don't let you shoot off the corner of the wall in the cannon, and that maybe there is a green star there if you go back later. I don't know, but
yeah, the throwback galaxy is the one you're referencing, I believe.
Throwback, yeah. It's awesome.
In my review, I mentioned that there's a galaxy that's a kind of retro that I don't want to spoil, and that was the one I was talking about.
The music is the best part, though, because you get
the music
with the live brass and that little guitar strumming along with it as well. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. So the next game I finished was Shadow of the Colossus HD, a game that I had beaten before back on PS2 a long time ago. But the HD version is a huge upgrade and is just much more playable, much smoother experience. And I had actually kind of forgotten a lot about how that game ends. Some of the implications in terms of what you see in the ending. I remember the kind of general thrust of it, but some of the details are, and the other thing is, the first time I beat Shadow back in 2005 or 2006, I hadn't beaten Ico. I'd barely played Eco, so there are connections between the two games that are at least implied, if not kind of overt. And I didn't get those back then. So now that I, you know, played Eco a few months ago when the HD collection came out, now I get it.
Yeah, aren't they supposed to happen in the same world or same universe or something?
Yeah, Ueda has kind of said basically he feels like they probably take place in the same world but maybe on opposite sides. Mm-hmm. So not anywhere near each other. None of the characters are the same. But there are elements that fit together. And it'll be interesting to see when The Last Guardian finally comes out, if that kind of keeps that up or if it's really a total refresh. But, you know, Shadow of the Colossus is a wonderful game. It does some absolutely amazing things. I think the final Colossus is a bit bullshitty in terms of the sequence that you have to go through. It's much more scripted than most of the other ones and much more difficult to figure out without checking a FAQ or asking someone, because it sort of breaks the signals that you're expecting the game to give you in terms of how to approach one of these bosses. It's annoying. It just kind of takes a long time to do, but it's very impressive and it's really cool. And when you finally beat him, it feels like you just blew up a mountain with a stick. I mean, it really does kind of feel like that. It's pretty amazing. And the ending is very weirdly cinematic. It's got a very long cutscene. It's a lot more story than you would expect from a game that has been very spare in that regard up to that point. And then finally, I finished off trying to... It is a superb game. I had a great, great time with it. I would highly recommend it to people. I think the production value is just so mind-boggling for a game that is $15, I think, on every platform. It's just unbelievable how good the graphics are, how good the music is. And how clever the game is, you might expect from an indie game, but wrapped up in the package that it is just amazing. And the great thing about it, it's not just pretty and it doesn't just sound good. The controls are wonderful. It's all physics-based platforming, and yet the controls and the jumping is really perfect. And I feel like the Little Big Planet guys could learn a lot from playing Trine and Trine 2. And seeing this is the way to do physics-based jumping the correct way. And as I was playing through the game, I kept thinking, you know, even though this is a 2D platformer, it feels pretty far from Mario because it's so slow-paced. There's so much manipulation in the environment and so much figuring out how to do things that you never really race through the game at all. You move very, very slowly through these very dense levels. And I realized that this is kind of the best elements of Mario, especially in terms of exploring and finding hidden places and being rewarded for it, like we talked about last time, and then some of the best aspects of Zelda in terms of the puzzle solving, in terms of understanding the environment that you're in and learning how to solve puzzles that are created out of that environment, and then mixing that in with your mobility and your methods of getting through the environment to solve puzzles. Very Zelda like that. And it took a long time for that comparison to hit me, but I think it's really true. And so I feel like, especially in Trine 2, more than in the first game, this is almost a perfect blend of 2D Mario games and Zelda gaming. It's a strange thing, but it really started to work on me the same way, and I started to get the same kind of satisfaction I do out of solving a Zelda dungeon, even though I'm playing a 2D platformer, and the platforming's still really good, and the combat is still, it's simple, but it's very fun and very satisfying, and they give you kind of the perfect amount of it to break up the puzzle so your brain doesn't get overworked. It's a fantastic game. It's really great, and I think Nintendo fans would do very well to check it out. It's on PC, Xbox, and PlayStation, so who knows, maybe Wii U. So check out Trine 2. And then finally, I did play the SSX demo that came out this week, and that looks pretty fun. I don't know if I love it as much as Striker Obi, but I don't know that anyone loves it as much as him.
Well, it's like tight jeans and sculpted face stubble for him.
Oh, wow. But it really, you know, I think any kind of trepidation about the whole Deadly Descents thing that they debuted the game with a couple years ago is... they clearly got the message. This feels like old school SSX in the best possible way. The graphics are really fantastic. I mean, they have upped the graphics, and it looks like a modern game, but it retains that SSX look to it, which we haven't seen in quite a while. And the controls feel really nice, and there's some options for the controls that I think are probably going to satisfy everybody. And I just had a really good time with it. I even like the music, which is surprising in an extreme sports game. That's a rare treat when they play a song that I actually like. I'm pretty excited about the final game. I mean, I expect it's probably going to get really good reviews. And if it does, then I might be picking it up a little bit later in the month of March. So that's all for me. And James is going to wrap up new business.
Yep. Don't have much to talk about. Busy, busy. Incredibly busy week. But what I did do is I went back and reevaluated one of the key talking points from our discussion last week with respect to what is gameplay. And I actually went back and reviewed one of the examples that came up a couple times, explicitly trying to find how it fits into our discussion point, which I went back and replayed LA Noire a bit, or picked up where I left off, is probably a better word for it. So I'm through the third desk at this point. The game's progression mechanism is silly. You just get bounced around detective desks, but whatever.
Did you finish the Black Dahlia stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm in sort of in the middle of it right now.
Yeah, so just as an aside before I really get into the gameplay discussion, it really feels like if you solve the murder of the Black Dahlia in a game about 1940s Los Angeles police enforcement, that should probably be the end of the game.
I've heard that argument. I've heard other people say they kind of wished it just ended at that point. Because
yeah, that
may also be because they don't like the content that comes up after it. But I agree, that seems like a pretty good climax.
It's like, if you solved one of the most famous and gruesome murders in the history of the United States, that should probably be the end of the game.
Yeah, there are multiple movies about that case.
Lots of them, including movies that came out very soon after the actual murder.
Yeah.
But no, they're like, no, we're taking you over to the vice desk now. It's like, what?
Dress you up in a pimp suit.
Yeah, it's like, wait a minute. You're taking me to a 1940s vice desk.
Yeah, that girl was showing her ankles in public.
I will break her. But what's funny is, so I sat down with the game and I said, okay, I'm going to play it like Johnny plays. I'm not going to drive around that much. Because as we've pointed out, you're driving yachts at this point.
It's better this way, right?
So that's where I kind of disagree, if we're discussing it in reference to the concept of gameplay. Because a lot of the game, you're not doing much this way. You're just sort of sitting there reading that guy's face. Is he blinking or is he making a nervous twitch?
Yeah, I guess I feel like the way I'm playing it, which is I don't do any optional stuff, including the driving. I go to the case, I solve the case, I go to the next case, period. And that experience feels very much like watching a 1940s style period detective show on TV. It's even paced like a TV show. Each one takes about 45 minutes, and it's mostly people talking to each other or walking from one place to another, and it's really all the meat and none of the frilly stuff on the outside. And, you know, I mean, you think about it like if you're watching a cop show on TV, they don't interrupt the important case that they're on to go solve some random street crime on the side. They let the boys in blue do that. You're a detective, damn it. You're on a case that's important. And so I just stay focused. And to me, the whole thing goes a lot more smoothly that way. And it's true, I'm probably interacting with the game less than if I was doing all the driving and solving all the other stuff. But that's okay with me because I feel like this experience is enjoyable. It's entertaining for me. On not so much in a video game kind of way, it's more like an interactive novel. You know, it's more like I'm seeing a good story, I'm seeing good acting and you know, some pretty cool storytelling and camera angles and everything else. I'm going to some nice locations and I'm kind of directing it in a almost a Heavy Rain kind of way, but it's much less of an action game this way, and that's fine with me.
It's more passive, but it's more fun for you.
Right. I'm kind of circumventing all the bullshit of the game, the stuff, the mechanics, which are there, but aren't very good.
So when you skip them, how bad they are, the actual shooting mechanics and the driving and the weird balance on tightrope shit you have to do at one point in the game. Like, it stands out in much starker relief when you're interrogating someone and he just runs off.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, "Go get him!" It's like, first off, the police in apparently the 40s were terrible at keeping a suspect in place because everybody runs. Usually they'll jump into a waiting vehicle and you jump into another waiting vehicle with no regard for whose vehicle that is and then prowl through the streets of Los Angeles in your land yachts. But well, you did the intolerance set scene, right?
Yes. That's a really cool location.
In that one, you're climbing through all this stuff, and what's interesting about it is it actually really scales the climbing down. I mean, Cole follows essentially when you're hitting straight. He'll start making all the turns for you. You just have to follow through on them.
Yeah.
You can't get lost because as long as you follow the way he leans into turns, you're okay. If you push against him, he'll let you go the other way, but you have to actively say, no, I don't want to turn that way. Mm-hmm. But the point is, it actually really minimizes the gameplay when you play it that way until you run into these kinds of like boss battle-y things like on the set of Intolerance, where you're platforming and shooting and being attacked by 800,000 gang members. I mean, there's a lot of action in that scene that's really cool. The game just doesn't stand up to it that well. And when you break it down like that, I feel like they tried to make this really cinematic thing and didn't pay enough attention to their gameplay.
Yeah, I think the mechanics could have been tightened up a lot, but I just don't think that's where their efforts were focused,
no.
Which is what you're saying. And then the other thing is, L.A. Noire was in development for a very long time, and I think you can tell that some of the parts of the game are just more modern than others. And I think some of these things like the driving and the shooting and the running,
mm-hmm.
they feel several years old. They feel almost from a previous generation or from a very early time in this generation, whereas a lot of the other stuff, it feels very innovative and very fresh and really technically on par with the best stuff that's going on right now. So it is a game that it's very lumpy and the pieces of it don't all quite match up. But the reason that we've talked about it so much and the reason it came up last week is because it's a different kind of game. I mean, it's a weird game. It does things differently than other games you've played. And so it is this kind of Elephant Man type thing where I just can't stop looking at it. There are times when I'm not as enamored with it. There are problems I have with it that are hard to overlook, but they're such weird problems that I just find them really fascinating.
It's got these kinds of adventure game elements. There's a lot of hybridization going on in its gameplay, and in some cases, abortions in the middle of it. And I don't mean that in the metaphorical sense. I mean, literally, like there's parts of gameplay elements they just cut out, and they're just not there, and you'd expect them to be there. In the case of its adventure, it's got adventure game elements, but ultimately, we talked about this before, they don't matter.
Well, you're graded at the end, so if you care
about that,
then it does matter. But in terms of advancing the story, no, it doesn't.
Which is the exact opposite of an adventure game, because if you don't find those fucking nachos, you are not going to be able to get to the next stage.
Right.
It's a very weird play on these different gameplay elements that it took from genres and then sort of just says, but we're not going to include this part.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've played a wide swath of gameplay styles, and I'd say I've done a decent job of that in my gaming career, you can see a lot of different games you've played in your life. You can see the gameplay elements of those games here at various spots, but it always just seems a little bit different. And in some cases, a lot of it different. And I think that's kind of an interesting experience for somebody who may not really enjoy this game as much as John did. It's like, I'm enjoying the story, but you know, a lot of times the gameplay, I'm like, oh, whatever, just do something else, please.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. It was the perfect game to be playing during our discussion of gameplay, though, because it's so weird.
It is a truly strange unicorn. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we've got your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with impressions. Aaron Kaluska returns to Kid Icarus Uprising, this time to look at its angelic multiplayer and collectible elements, particularly the weapons. And then they also have impressions of Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater 3D, the demo, by Zach Miller, who says that awkward controls are the name of the game, and I can independently confirm that face buttons are a pretty poor substitute for a second circle pad.
Yep, I can confirm that from E3. Oh. We have more impressions, because we need more impressions all the time. This time we have impressions of Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy by Danny Bivens. But really, it's more impressions of the DLC set, two of which came out in less than a week for the 3DS in Japan.
Oh, Japan.
This game sold really well, so there'll probably be a lot more of it.
Yeah.
We also have a preview of PokéPark 2 Wonders Beyond, which Josh Max will maybe tell you what the wonders are beyond and what wonders they are in the newest PokéPark.
All right, Neil Ronahan gives us a review of Dylan's Rolling Western on 3DS, and he says, "Somebody poisoned the waterhole."
Yes.
Neil Ronahan, again, gives us a review of Dr. Lautrec and the Forgotten Knights on 3DS, and he says, Dr. Lautrec is like Professor Layton if Layton was a total jerk and his games were a mess.
Hey, there's a Pokemon element to this game which makes it seem even less appealing.
All right. Also this week, we've got a new batch of Virtual Console recommendations by JP, Andy, and Neil. And these are recommendations for Bionic Commando on the eShop for Game Boy, Maru's Mission, also for Game Boy, and Fazanadu, the NES game that you can get on the Wii Virtual Console, all featured in this retro roundup. We've also got a feature, it's Metal Gear The Primer, by Nate Andrews and Zach Miller.
It's actually Metal Gear Paint.
And they say, don't go into Snake Eater 3D naked, do some background reading on Kojima's notoriously intricate fiction. And it's true, actually, if you're not familiar with Metal Gear, jumping into the third game on 3DS without reading up anything about it might be a bad idea.
Or still playing the first game might be a bad idea. You're just as confused.
And of course, we've also got all the news from the Nintendo Direct Conference. We certainly didn't cover everything in new business, so be sure to check that out and see what else you missed.
Dr. Kawashima with devil horns. Go.
Okay, welcome back to the show. It's time for the listener mail. Our email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Don't worry, I'll repeat it again at the end. And there is a link on our website where you can click to if you don't want to try to remember the address.
You bastard.
So John is going to read the first email this week.
Skytar writes, have you ever had an experience with video games where you know you ought to be doing something really important, but instead you're too hooked by the game to be bothered to do it? Like recently, when I had to write a 3-page paper for a history class, but instead played Rhythm Heaven Fever for 3 hours. If so,
I can see that.
Then what was the important thing you were supposed to be doing, and what game were you so enthralled by?
Mine was college, and the game was all of them.
Yeah, this has happened to me so many times, it's hard to remember a specific instance, actually.
Also, it was high school. Again, all of them.
For me, this was an issue going all the way back to...
It wasn't middle school, because I had an N64.
It wasn't so much an issue, it was a perceived issue. Back in the elementary school, even.
Obviously, it had a terrible, ruinous effect on your academic career.
Yes, right? Exactly.
I think it just put you off the idea of education altogether.
Yeah, and that was always my argument was, look, my grades are really great. I'm not struggling in school. Why can't I just play my video games all night long?
So apparently you wanted to play them for so long that you actually just compensated and got a PhD. You overcompensated and got a PhD. So there you go.
You want, now I can play games all I want, bitch. What?
That's right. What are you going to say? I got a PhD. I can't get no more degrees.
I just like the image of Johnny walking around. That's Dr. Bitch.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Dragging an Atari behind him. Yeah. What now? I'm going to ET up in this.
It actually became... It didn't really become an issue until probably middle school when I started to get a significant amount of homework, which is not, you know, homework doesn't magically do itself no matter how smart you are or how smart you think you are or how well you're doing in the class. You know, even if you pick up all the answers from the lecture, you still have to actually sit down and spend the time and do the homework, which I, you know, of course felt was bullshit, but everybody does at the time. And that's where I started to have to pay a little more attention. And I did occasionally get into trouble, and, you know, there were some reports I turned in way late because I'd been playing Final Fantasy all weekend long and didn't get around to it. And, I got in trouble with my mom a couple times for stuff like that, but it's never too bad. And by the time college came around, it was more like, well, I can always sacrifice sleep, you know.
Yep.
You can't really get away with that when you live with your parents, but when you're on your own in college, it's like, yeah, I stayed up too late playing this game and I got this thing due tomorrow, but I guess I'll just stay up all night and do it anyway.
Exactly. Hand it in at 8 a.m. before your professor comes into class.
That's right. Yeah. There's a point in college when you begin to rationalize and you'll think, yeah. Well, I write my best paper when I'm tired anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. When does my prof check the Dropbox?
Oh, yeah.
Once that kicks in, this becomes a problem. So yeah. For me, I had a, I majored in computer science. I had a lot of projects I had to do. I had a lot of research papers I had to do. I actually had a research paper in one class and a massive simulator doing another. And meanwhile, God, what game was it? It must have been Wind Waker. And, no, it was Twilight Princess. Yeah, and I remember thinking, oh shit, I'm done. Because I'm playing it while I'm trying to read research documents, which isn't going well. And like, all right, I'll just brainstorm my simulator code. This will be fine. I don't think I slept for 4 days when I realized the deadline was about to hit. And then I went home and played the rest of Wind Waker and passed out on the sofa while playing it. It was good.
That's always a good feeling when you fall asleep.
Guess you weren't enjoying Twilight Princess that much, so you went and played Wind Waker instead.
That's right. Sorry, Twilight Princess. I don't know why you...
this has never been a problem for me, ever. Has playing video games been at the expense of anything other than academia been a problem? Yes.
Yeah, I can say that too, definitely.
But I've always, with academic work or the other kind of work, it was always just something I did afterwards. I remember when I was doing my first year A-levels, I unwound by trying to finally beat Sin and Punishment on hard in one life.
Good.
And it worked quite well.
You know? You are a special breed.
Mm-hmm. It just, well, if you want to take your mind off the really soul-crushing revision and whatnot, that will hone your brain and make everything else seem very easy in comparison.
I actually skipped my first graduation from college with my bachelor's degree. I skipped the graduation ceremony so I could be at E3.
Nice. That's worthwhile, though.
Yeah, my parents were not thrilled with that decision.
I can't imagine the ways I would have been slain. Oh. I mean, it would have been gruesome.
It's totally worth it. That was the year that we discovered the name of the Nintendo DS before it was officially announced.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Metz is old.
He's a child to me, a mere babe in the woods.
I am 30, yes. Rub it in, James, please.
I was 6 years out of college in 2004. I was still talking on the Zach Morris huge phone.
Jesus!
Look it up. Look up the meme.
Oh my God! Next question!
Okay, so Greg has the next email.
Pete writes, so, what has to be the largest quandary in every discussion I've heard on the 3DS in the last year or so is a complete and utter lack of discussion as to its horrifyingly bad native mode. This being the mode used to play DS, DSiWare, and more recently GBA games, is vaguely acceptable for DS and DSi software, but totally unacceptable for GBA games, which almost makes me hope these never go on sale in the eShop. What I'm referring to is the fact that while the 3DS is running GBA software, it cannot do the following. Sleep when the lid is closed, go to the home screen, resume, this is Virtual Console after all, Street Pass Spot Pass, and Play Coin Acquisition. So basically, while the 3DS is busy emulating games from two portable generations ago, it cannot take advantage of a single one of its own features, let alone features that make the Wii Virtual Console such a pleasant experience. The reason all this bothers me is that, at the end of the day, it's truly a lack of resource spending on Nintendo's part. The 3DS processor is easily fast enough to run something like GPSP at native speeds, let alone a custom emulator built by the company that got 32 meg N64 titles running smoothly on a system with 24 megs of RAM. As such, while it doesn't truly infuriate me on the current batch of GBA releases, mainly because they were free, it really would bother me if Nintendo were to put them on sale as VC titles, as I think these caveats substantially diminish their usefulness.
Yeah, for the DS games, I think it's somewhat excusable if you understand the technical basis, because I'm pretty sure that DS games are running on 3DS in hardware emulation and not software emulation. So basically, the 3DS is turning off certain chips that aren't needed and tricking the game card. Because remember, this is a card. I mean, DSiWare is a somewhat different story. But in terms of putting a DS game into the system, they're basically tricking the DS game card into thinking that it's in a DS and not a 3DS. So they're turning things off. And so it's kind of the same problem of running GameCube games on Wii. It could have been handled better, but it is what it is. And it ensures the greatest compatibility So it's kind of the way that you get it to support virtually all DS games out of the box on launch day. It rather than do it the Xbox 360 way, where in order for them to support original Xbox games, they have to do it in software, which means they have a compatibility list that they sort of update over time as they continue to improve the emulator. And then at some point they say, okay, we give up. It's diminishing returns or whatever. And that was 2 years after the system launched. So it was really kind of a long period where they were doing that. So I think it's excusable for DS games. And to be fair with DS games, you do still get things like you can shut the system and close it because it's a DS game. It expects that the hardware supports that. So that stuff does work. It's just, it's not going to support Street Pass while you're playing a DS game. I wish it would, but it's not really feasible.
No, I mean, you could do it, but you'd have to be really careful. I mean, it's complicated. It's very complicated.
I understand why they don't do that. For GBA games, it's a very fair complaint, but at the same time, they aren't selling GBA games yet on Virtual Console, and when they do, I think they're going to add some of this stuff, just like they have with Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the NES games were much closer to their finished counterparts originally, you know, because they did have a suspend state, if not a save state, at that point and all that kind of thing. Whereas GBA games, you know, if they're going to happen, which we all think they will, but clearly it would be some greater time off. And it seems to me what the GBA games are doing is a bit like what it's doing with the DS, in that they're kind of emulating it by making the 3DS think that it's a DS playing a GBA game. That seems like what they're doing here, and that's why it doesn't have any additional features.
That's probably exactly what they're doing, yeah.
Despite the fact that, you know, it is two generations removed and all that, you know, it's just that evidently, you know, this ambassador program was not in their original thinking, as was cutting the price of the hardware globally by about a third. You know, this was all a bit rushed, and so I am glad that they were actually willing to give us these games in a somewhat compromised state, but they're still there. I'm still happy that we got. I think it's a great gift to have. And I certainly look forward to the day, if it comes, where we could upgrade, you know, all those ambassador games to the full point where they've got all the features of all the rest of the eShop Virtual Console releases.
Yeah, I mean, like playing something like Fire Emblem really made me miss the convenience of just being able to slap the thing shut and save power and just pause it that way.
If you've seen what the Game Gear emulator supposedly is going to look like, I think you can kind of map out what it's going to look like for us in the future. I mean, it's my understanding that it actually looks quite good.
I saw that they've got some visual effects options there. I mean, obviously, with the current systems, you know, you can do the select trick or whatever and have it be in the frame, so it's kind of pixel for pixel, and it looks like it's playing on an old system. But
bad idea on the GBA, by the way, because you get this kind of GB micro type size display.
Yeah.
Very hard to see. It's just so small. And I do think the pixel doubling is not very good. I mean, the stretch mode for GBA is really not very flattering at all on these games.
Although, I kind of have to see how stretched out the DS games look. I thought GB games would be really bad looking. They still don't look great at all, blown up.
It's the aspect ratio. GBA was more widescreen than the DS screen.
True, yeah, that mitigates it a little bit.
So I think it just fits that upper screen better.
But they don't look great. But with the Game Gear, I think you've got options to like kind of have a visual effect that emulates the ghosting that was inherent to the Game Gear screen and stuff like that. You know,
that's
a cute little thing that they put in there.
Yeah, so I would imagine if Nintendo's going to let Sega do that, they aren't going to be shown up on their own system when they release GBA emulated games.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is all pointing to the fact that we really should hope that they sell these GBA games, because when they do, that means that
we get them for free.
Well, it means the ambassadors are going to get the upgrades that we want. Whereas if they never sell GBA games on Virtual Console,
this is all we'll ever have.
We're probably stuck with the way it is now, which is, again, they're playable, but it is really kind of sad considering some of these games are 10 years old or more than 10 years old, and it's not the real Virtual Console experience, you know, just like Pete is saying. I mean, if you were playing these games on the Wii Virtual Console, you would expect certain things like the suspend feature to work or to be able to bring up the home screen overlay. That's, I think, important to have. It is disappointing, but, you know, like Greg said, this is probably just a consequence of them making this stuff work as fast as possible in the simplest, most straightforward, robust way they could find. So I understand why it's not very feature complete, but I certainly do hope that they're going to revisit this stuff in the future and and supply those features, you know, just like they are with the NES games. I think it'll happen. So the next email is from Travis in Los Angeles. Travis writes, I own both a DSi and a 3DS and have been unsure of which system I should use to play DSiWare games. I still play DS titles using my DSi as the games look better on that system. And I'm wondering if the same goes for DSiWare games. For which system are DSiWare games being designed? I enjoy being able to use the 3DS as my primary handheld system, but does a bigger screen and better DS resolution outweigh the convenience of using one handheld? To those of you who own both systems, which systems do you use to play DSiWare games?
Well, I mean, I don't own a 3DS, but if I did, I would use a DSi, personally.
Yeah, James is the only one who has both here.
I would say that if that's how you feel about DS games, you should probably use the DSi.
Yeah, it is the same. I have some DSiWare games like Mighty Milky Way and Xscape. Obviously, I've never had a DSi, but you can tell it's the same upscaling thing that's going on, you know, when you don't have it in the pixel-for-pixel micro mode. It's getting sort of stretched out onto the higher-res 3DS screen, and it doesn't look great. Kind of looks a bit washed out as well as a consequence of that.
Yes.
It's not just that it seems a bit blurry, but it does seem to compromise the intensity, you know, how vibrant the colours are and all that kind of thing. So I think it may well depend on the kind of DSi game we're talking about here. You know, if it's something that perhaps is more visually leveraged, let's say like Shantae, then you might really want to preserve that looking as best possible on the DSi. Whereas if it was something that's like a puzzle game that you want to have quick access to all the time, though the visuals are not that important, you know, then maybe you put that on your 3DS, which you're going to have with you more often.
Mm-hmm. I think the solution really is pretty simple here. It sounds like Travis is already kind of hanging on to his DSi in order to play DS games, which right. I completely understand, because the DS games are not presented terribly well on the 3DS. So if you're already, my DS Lite pretty much hasn't been touched since I got a 3DS. You know, I've kind of dealt with the shortcomings. I also haven't played a lot of DS games. I have played a few DSiWare games, not heavily. But I would say if you're already used to having your DSi out to play Radiant Historia, which is being reprinted in the near future, or something else, you know, whatever it is, you might as well download the DSiWare games that you want to play onto that same system, because you've got it out anyway. And then over time, you will probably naturally migrate away from your DSi and want to spend more time with your 3DS and have that be the one that you carry around with you. And when that time comes, you can just transfer all the DSiWare games. Now, you can't transfer them from a 3DS back to a DSi. So if you download them to your 3DS, you're kind of stuck with them there.
It's like the you have a cat, a dog, and a mouse on in a boat.
The Leighton puzzle.
One will eat the other. Yes, that's I remember that from Highlights back in the 80s. But
damn right, you had to use the stickers that came with it to solve the puzzle.
Yeah. So anyway, I think if you've got nothing to lose by downloading them to your DSi, playing them there. And then eventually, when you kind of decide that you're probably not going to be playing your DSi as much anymore and you have more to do on your 3DS and you really want to consolidate your library, then you can just transfer them over.
For me, I don't have both. Obviously, I don't have the choice, but it is actually coming into play because on the release schedule for Europe that we talked about earlier, they do have Cave Story again for DSiWare slotted for March. So it's been a saga, as we've touched on before, about that popping up. But of course, for me, I have no choice. If I wanted the DSiWare version, it would be on my 3DS, in which case it wouldn't look that great.
Right.
It wouldn't be as crisp as it would be on a DSi, which for that kind of retro style game, I think, you know, it's important that it looks really sort of sharp like that. So it's kind of one knock against the DSiWare version relative maybe to the 3DS version, you know, the retail
right.
version. It is kind of affecting my decision making in that regard. But I mean, I do wonder though, does it kind of raise the question now, you know, some of these DSiWare games that are getting, you know, there's still a lot of DSiWare that gets released, you know, every week.
Huge sums of it.
To what extent do you think developers now are actually looking at that and expecting people to be playing it on their 3DS more than their DSi, just because, you know, that's the handheld that they're using, and also because, you know, maybe the eShop is better to find even DSiWare
I'm not sure how much you can design your game for the 3DS, though, if it has to work on the
DSi.
Not
so much design your game, but maybe the promotion and the marketing and all that kind of
stuff. Oh, yeah, I would say that is probably very much the case.
And I wonder how much feedback they get from Nintendo in terms of the breakdown. I wonder if they get data on how many copies are sold for DSi.
They get the sales data, yes. And I'm sure they get the breakdown to an extent.
It's an interesting question, but I think the safe bet is to go ahead and buy it on the DSi shop. Just, you know, plan it. Don't use that to browse. Plan ahead.
You've already made your mind up.
Use the eShop on your 3DS to do your shopping, and then just write down the titles you want to buy, and then go to the DSi.
Well, you don't have to write them down. Just leave the eShop on it and have a single tear come down your face when you open up the DSi shop and put them next to each other.
Yeah. Hey, James, do you find that you're still using your big boy?
Oh, Big Hoss? Yeah, Big Hoss gets used.
Yeah, the XL.
If I'm playing a DS game, I'm playing it on the XL.
But are you actually playing DS games lately?
I have two that are in the chute to go.
Do you think you're going to bring it? Are going to travel with it like to PAX East?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to bring both.
Yeah, I have the case for it, so it's fine.
But don't you have to pay to check it?
Yeah, I do actually. I have to buy the second seat. But yeah, I'll play Tingle on there, and I'll play the other DS mystery game to be announced at a later date.
You're so coy.
Yeah, and I think this is a mystery game when he's being upfront and candid about Tingle.
Right.
So, that's how you build suspense, folks.
Yeah, really.
That's going to be such a letdown.
Okay, so James is actually going to read the final email.
Hanabishi writes, I recently finally managed to find time to begin playing Skyward Sword. I started the game last weekend, I'm about 30 hours in. Motion Plus works well, and this is easily the most fun Zelda game I've played, thanks to the items, the new bombs, the flying beetle, and the air blower thing are fantastic. But I feel like this came at the cost of everything else. When EAD first started talking about how Skyward Sword was set in a school, and how there's going to be high school drama, I imagined something like Hogwarts from Harry Potter. Basically, a school where the characters share real relationships with one another, but there's a, quote, culture to the world that you can really buy into. Skyward Sword doesn't have anything of the sort, unfortunately. The characters feel shallow, the world feels dull, the sky feels empty, and Skyloft doesn't feel like a real place. I kind of feel like they cheated with the whole, quote, densely packed thing, too. The only reason this game is, again, quote, densely packed, is because there aren't many areas to begin with, and each one is reused extensively. This makes me wonder, just what were they doing for 5 years? For example, it certainly wouldn't take a Western developer, or even Retro Studios for that matter, this long to pull out a game with a believable world and believable characters. Is Aonuma's team no longer capable of evolving Zelda into the kind of game the fans want? I understand if they had stuck to the same childlike design and a new generation of kids had jumped in with each Zelda game, a la Pokemon, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Skyward Sword sales haven't been up to expectations in any territory by Iwata's own admittance. Zelda's no longer at a point where it doesn't have competition anymore. Plenty of games from Uncharted to Assassin's Creed fall into the same wide, quote, third-person action-adventure genre, and those games are growing while Zelda isn't. Perhaps now really is the best time for someone to pull Retro Studios in to help, because I feel like their expertise building worlds and doing it efficiently is something that Zelda could really use. Because you're wrong.
Yeah, James obviously disagrees with the whole Retro Studio. Well, is there a different studio that you would like to see outside of, you know, Nintendo EAD?
Not really, no. I mean, I think
you like Skyward Sword plenty, you know, we all did.
Yeah, but my two favorite Zelda games were developed under his stewardship. Mm-hmm. I love Majora's Mask. It's amazing. And I love Wind Waker. It's also amazing. I'm really happy with them. I just don't feel that strongly about Twilight Princess. I feel like the whole wolf thing was kind of stupid. And I don't care for a lot of what Skyward Sword did in the densely packed stuff. I agree with what he said there. I feel like the whole, we're going to pack everything into three sections, and we're just going to make Skyloft this big empty space, was really kind of wasteful and didn't really fit the Zelda dynamic. I feel like if they had stuck closer to their roots in that aspect, they probably would have had a better game overall.
Well, and even then, I think about like the forest in Skyward Sword. It's not that dense.
No, not really.
You go through it a lot of times, but
it's not dense enough to support the amount of times you go back there.
No,
it's more dense than a Hyrule Field in Twilight Princess. Yes, obviously. Yeah.
Over the course of the game, it still feels like it isn't necessarily that densely packed, and we've talked about that plenty of times.
Right.
There's a few issues in here that I'd like to tackle. First of all, just briefly, something I've mentioned before, you know, the whole 5 years thing, don't get too caught up in that. They were not making the game for 5 years. We all know that. Remember that EAD was responsible for making Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks as well. It's not just EAD, you know, it's the same people, not just Aonuma overseeing it, but actually...
The same director, I mean.
The director of the game, of Skyward Sword, worked on those games, you know. I'm sure, you know, there was a certain amount of parallel development going on, all this kind of stuff, but, you know, the idea that they had undivided attention on Skyward Sword for 5 years is a fallacy.
There might have been some people who that was what they worked on, but yeah, the big brains were working on both games.
The thing is, I think what he's getting at, though, is it seems like the series itself isn't evolving very much. I mean, from Skyward Sword, it kind of feels like a time capsule in some ways. Like, ever since, like, not much has changed in terms of the 3D games themselves.
Right.
So I think when he's talking about series like Uncharted, and even though a lot of the series that he's talking about are actually newer series, so of course they're...
Right.
They're newer and fresher and different.
Is Uncharted really that different from other games, though? I mean, it does a lot of things other games do. It borrows pretty heavily.
Yeah, but I think the point is that Skyward Sword, I think he probably would have expected it to maybe incorporate elements from newer games to a higher degree than it actually did.
But I think a key component of this question, Hanabi says, is Aonuma's team no longer capable of evolving Zelda into the kind of game that fans want? Well, what exactly is that? Because I don't think there is one thing.
No. I mean, I want Wind Waker 2, but I'm probably not in the majority there.
I mean, the point is that Zelda, it's a lot of different things. And even, especially if you look at the whole spectrum of the series going all the way back to the NES, it's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And people like different aspects of it more than others. Others and some would prefer greater focus on the narrative, voice acting, this sort of thing. Some would prefer a more demanding action component to the game and less puzzle solving. Others prefer an open world scenario where it's about exploring and it's not so linear.
I would say that Skyward Sword is especially linear.
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible to take a poll of Zelda fans and get like a very clear indication of this is where they want it to go.
Right.
Because I think there's a lot of different things that people want out of it because they like different things in the first place. Some of that based on which ones they played first and then some of it just based on their gaming taste. But that does present a problem for Nintendo in terms of, well, what direction do we take it in?
They're not going to please everybody regardless.
You are going to annoy some people, whatever you do.
Right.
I think this is where you have the fact that the Wii is not an HD console kind of catching up with this series, because I know for a fact that people look at Skyrim and they say, wow, Skyrim is this, that, and the other. It's a huge world, blah, blah, blah. Why can't Skyward Sword do that? And it'll be interesting to see with the Wii U, the next game in the series, where Nintendo goes with that, with the added power of that console.
Yeah, I think the fact that Zelda has so many different components, and the games have covered, you know, a lot of ground over the years, you know, the top-down style, the 3D style, even within that, there's a lot of variety. Then you've got Zelda 2, is very weird. You know, they've got a lot of things to draw upon that they could take in different directions. And I mean, look at the Mario games. I mean, Mario is much more narrow in many ways, and yet they've been quite happy to say, well, let's have 3D games on a console at the same time as having New Super Mario Brothers, at the same time as having 3D Land, which is something between the two. I mean, I think the time has come for them to do more in terms of differentiating different strands of the series a bit more. I mean, they've done it with stuff like Four Swords Adventures in the past, and I think that was good. I've never played it, but I've always wanted to play it because I really like the idea of kind of going back to the top-down gameplay there. But I think now what you're seeing is with Phantom Hourglass Spirit Tracks and Skyward Sword. They're obviously very different in many ways, but they also have quite a lot in common, in the sense that, okay, well, we're going to have a lot of emphasis on the kind of the input mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's different. It's innovative. You know, maybe it's more intuitive in some ways, or, you know, people could get into it more easily. And then also the extent to which it's very puzzle driven. So the fact that they've had this sort of commonality of approach between the two there in terms of handheld and portable, I think you could definitely say, let's bring in someone like Retro to do one strand and leave EAD to do another. You know, maybe that's the way that you could evolve the series at the same time as keeping maybe not all of the people happy all of the time, but certainly without just completely abandoning a certain sector of the fan base. Because as Hanabishi raises, you know, Zelda is not a growing series and they need to do something to kind of rediscover some commercial success here. I mean, obviously, Phantom Hourglass was successful to some extent in the middle of the big DS craze, if you like, in Japan especially.
Spirit Tracks was a bomb, especially in Japan.
Yeah, that was not sustained. So to some extent, I think having multiple different evolutions of the series happening at the same time with different developers is good from the point of view of a laboratories of democracy kind of idea of like, let's see what actually works commercially and what doesn't with Zelda. And maybe that can tell them how they want to take it forward from that point of view, as well as keeping multiple factions within the fan base happy at the same time.
Well, and I think it's also important that if they have these different Zelda gene pools going at the same time, you can cycle them better. And you can keep one thing from being what Zelda is, kind of like they're doing with Mario's right now, like Greg said.
Side-scroller. Zelda 2, bring it back.
No.
I'm big on the idea of having a new top-down Zelda, many reasons. I mean, I talked about this a bit playing A Link to the Past last year, just how brisk it is. You know, all the things that you sort of complain about, things taking too long or too much filler and all that, you know, you don't get that in A Link to the Past. And the fact is, a lot of it is to do with being top-down and just having a world that in that way is so transparent, and how you can interact with it is so transparent. You don't really need a lot explained to you in that case, you know. You could just sort of pick it up intuitively. And I'm a big fan of Minish Cap, but even Minish Cap is very influenced by the 3D games.
It is.
Right.
It's much more item driven. It's much more puzzle driven. There's a lot, I think there's a lot of mileage that they could get out of maybe reassessing Zelda from a sort of first principles point of view.
If you look at 3D Dot Heroes, though, it's...
Yeah, but in all fair, I like 3D Dot Game Heroes. Right? I do like that game. I played it and I enjoyed it. But at the end of the day, Nintendo can do better.
There's no doubt. But I also think that it shows that the charm of that kind of game is more nostalgic than it is just a strictly better kind of game.
No, I wouldn't say it's anything about strictly better, but what you have in the old Zeldas is something that's more an immediate kind of game.
Sure.
But I wouldn't advocate that it would be like the new Legend of Zelda, where it's pretty much just like A Link to the Past or something, and you don't do anything from there. You know, I think they should actually use that as a starting point and then maybe, you know, take it in some different directions.
But you can also argue that they've already basically done what you're talking about with Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks. They're kind of top-down Zeldas, but with some newer stuff mixed in.
No, the overworlds are appallingly bad.
Okay,
whereas
I agree completely.
They are empty and as barren as anything in the 3D Zeldas, whereas the stars of the show in the 2D ones, the top-down, are the overworlds.
It's true.
No, it really is its own lineage at this point.
So, I mean, I just think that there's mileage to sort of reassess what you could do with this series because it's so big, because it has tried its hand at so many different elements to the point now with Skyward Sword where, you know, you've got all these different sorts of inputs that are just like, you know, Wii Sports. It's got that kind of range and all that. It might be an idea to split things off and focus a little bit more on certain kinds of gameplays rather than, you know, one of the compliments that was paid to Skyward Sword by a lot of reviews was that, and I think it's legitimate, is that it basically feels like this is the culmination version of Wii. You know, it incorporates everything that the Wii has ever tried to do into it. And, you know, it's the sort of great signature send off for the system that does it. And that's admirable. And,
right.
But at the same time, I think there's something to be said for a more focused experience. Yeah. And Zelda doesn't always have to be this game that carries the weight of, like, well, it justifies the hardware because you do it all touch or you do it all motion. This is to have a bit more of a just let's look at what can make a compelling Zelda game rather than a compelling Wii U game, a compelling 3DS game.
And see, I think that's the point. I don't think we need to bring in other people to do that. I think that just needs to be the objective they're given.
Yes, I'm sure that comes from up high.
Handing it off as a shortcut to getting a fresh look. It's not the only way to do it.
Well, and that's why they need a fresh look. I think they just need to be told, look, you're not required to make this game all Wii U tablety. Just make a good Zelda game.
And I mean, to be fair, one thing you have to say in some sense, obviously it's sad that the commercial fortunes are declining in some sense, but it also makes it perhaps more and more tenuous that this would be the flagship game that has to show off every single aspect of the hardware.
Yeah, it's a good point. Now, another part we haven't talked about as much from Hanabishi's letter is he talks about the world-building aspect and how he felt there was kind of a lot of wasted potential in the setup, in the backstory of Link being a student at the school. And I completely agree. I think a lot of the world of Skyward Sword seems really interesting when you first see it, and then you find out there's really nothing under the surface. And that's a feeling that I was really kind of tired of the world towards the end, because it's very fresh at the beginning. You're running around the city and you think, wow, this is all really cool. And then you're flying around and, you know, you go down to the ground and you see these kind of new environments, but they don't seem to really take it anywhere. And I think, you know, some people say, well, that's not what Zelda's about. But I think if you go back to Onuma's first game that he was in charge of, Majora's Mask, I think that is a game where the world is really probably the key defining feature of the entire game.
Well, and the moon.
No, it's the end of the world. That's the point. The fact that it is in peril is integral to how you experience it.
I mean, Link is just learning this world for the first time, and it's going to be gone in 3 days.
Right. And it is truly densely packed, much more so than anything in Skyward Sword.
Even Termina, there's stuff going on in the field. I mean,
exactly.
On the schedule. I mean, but again, that's because it's kind of like a cuckoo clock.
Yes.
Exactly. That is, it's a tough trick to pull twice, what they did in Majora's Mask.
Yeah.
But they tried a bit, didn't they? It's like, they're called gratitude crystals things or some of these side quests.
That's so lame.
A lot of them don't really actually. I was expecting a lot of that to happen in the school, kind of what Hanabishi was saying. But actually, a lot of them was happening around town, you know. Yeah,
right.
Can
you go ahead and dust my apartment?
But because it's just, you've basically just got day and night. That's it.
Right.
You've got two states.
At night you're being attacked by cats.
You know, it can't have the nuance that you have in Majora's Mask when it's so intricately plotted along a defined cycle.
And look, the whole cuckoo clock thing is a way to do it. There are other ways to do it. But I think the feeling that the characters in this world have relationships with each other that are believable and you can affect their relationships and these people are living their lives and it the world is so much more fully fleshed out on far inferior hardware and the game is, you know, now 12 years old and yet it feels like they accomplished something there. They achieved a level of immersion and world building that they haven't really gone back to. I think in Wind Waker, they did a really good job, and I think they created an interesting world. Now, some people don't like that world as much because it is very expansive and kind of sparsely populated, but I think in terms of creating a place that really feels like a place, you know, that really has its own kind of character to it, and you fill it with characters who have real personality who you might actually care about. I don't think Skyward Sword does that as well.
But this is the point for me, is that a lot of the times it's a question of priorities. And you look at Majora's Mask, and the world-building part of that was the priority. In large part because Ocarina of Time already existed, and it was in the recent past. You know, they had already made the big generation-defining game. And so Majora's Mask represented an opportunity to make it more specific, to narrow the focus. You know, you're doing it on a condensed timeline as well, development-wise, so that kind of forced them to do this. But but in a weird way, it gave them sort of a freedom and constraints at the same time to create something that was focused around very particular priorities rather than trying to be everything to everyone.
And that's what I was hoping that Skyward Sword was going to be that again. I was hoping it was going to be the Majora's Mask because they've got, you know, fundamentally the same level of technology and they'd like to turn out a game in relatively short time. And the DS games really pushed this so far out that they really had to start over from scratch, especially, and Motion Plus did too. And so, but I feel like Skyward Sword might have had a stronger focus on things like crafting the world and making the story more interesting and making the characters more believable, and all that stuff might have benefited from it coming out sooner because they would have had less time to tinker with the tech, and that might have had to been more of the focus. But I think these DS games, you know, I don't begrudge them for Phantom Hourglass. I think it was a bold thing.
I like Phantom Hourglass.
I like it too. I think I don't love it, but I like it. And I think the way that they did it was very bold and innovative, and you know, not just the controls, but the idea of the Zelda team is going to make a portable Zelda game. That had not really happened since Link's Awakening. And you know, I think giving it the focus that they did, it was a very high production value game, very impressive game. I don't begrudge them that. I would prefer if Spirit Tracks had never been made. Not because I necessarily regret the time I spent with it, but I think when you look at what it probably did to the development track of Skyward Sword, and just, I don't think it adds that much to the canon.
I don't think it really was responsible for Skyward Sword coming out when it did. I mean, I think that decision was made by someone else.
It's hard to, you're just speculating. It's hard to say.
It could have.
I'm happy with, I mean, there are things about Spirit Tracks I dislike, but I'm happy with it.
Spirit Tracks is the biggest dichotomy for me. The dungeons are fantastic. And
they're amazing.
And you guys like those more than I do, so I'm more mellow on it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but I feel like there's significant improvement over Phantom Hourglass, so that way I'm glad it exists, because it kind of takes some of those concepts that they had in there and realizes them more fully, and with puzzles that are more varied, more interesting, and more challenging. So that's how I'm kind of glad to see some of those things come to full flower. But on the other hand, a lot of the deficiencies were not corrected, you know, because the overworld is worse, if anything, and it was bad to start with. But I mean, I think the problem is, the later it went with Skyward Sword, the more it's got to be like I said, this has got to be the culmination of everything.
Right,
and what happens at that point is, it's like, well, we'd like to put some of these elements in terms of Link's a regular guy, and he comes from this town, and he's, you know, there's people that already know him,
and he's not wrestling yaks.
They have relationships with each other and all this kind of stuff. But the problem is that can't really be the focus of the game when you're doing all this other stuff.
Well, you know, I think if you go back and look at Majora's Mask at a couple different angles, why it works so well is that it rewards you for observing their behaviors. I think if you weren't being rewarded for basically spying on every person in town.
Which is what kind of lost me, but that was also what made the game really unique.
Yeah, I think,
it wasn't like any game I'd ever played.
There you go. I think that's it. I think if you aren't really all that interested or don't really get into watching these events transpire, I think you could easily walk through these towns and just feel people are just wandering around for no apparent reason whatsoever if you aren't going to sit there and really observe their happenings. I think the game incentivizes you sitting there and really watching so well.
Which to me, I was like, I'm playing an action game. I don't want to sit around observing people or being in the right place at the right time.
Look, that kid is an adult and he needs your help, okay? Also, there are UFOs trying to steal milk. I mean, that game really is on drugs, though. It's messed up.
Yeah, but, you know, I think a lot of the confidence to be that wacky, to be that narrow, it's a Zelda game with four dungeons. I mean, the main Zelda games, they would never sort of allow that to be the case, because it's like, well, it's certain expectations. It's got to be this long. It's got to be this big. They wouldn't let that happen. But because of the nature of Majora's Mask, they let them do certain things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think that's the important distinction. When you talk about bringing in outside developers, this is where you go back to what James said. Yeah, maybe Retro Studios could churn out a world more quickly or more fully because of their experience. I don't know. But, I mean, to me, the real thing is if the remit for Retro Studios is basically to do what's already been done in the previous games, but in HD, and that's not going to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have it from the top.
Right.
Saying, this is where we want to go, and you're the people to take us there. And they may well be uniquely equipped to take Zelda in a different direction compared to other developers inside Nintendo. But unless the guys at the top are Numa, Miyamoto, and to some extent even Iwata, you have to think with the commercial motives in play, set the destination.
I think if you don't have those three really providing where this thing should go, and maybe you, at this point, you even include, and I can't remember his name now, but
Kensuke Tanabe is the one I would really like to be in there.
And of course, he's got history with Zelda.
He was also a producer on Metroid Prime, so I don't know how James feels about that.
I think at this point, I mean, if you just hand him it to make a Zelda game, I think you'd get something not very good if you don't have the people who really know that franchise, who have lived that franchise for decades, really saying, this is what our vision needs to be. I think you'd end up with something that doesn't feel Zelda.
It'll be interesting to see if the Wii U Zelda, if they want it to come out soon, then they pretty much would have had to hand it off to another developer to work on while EAD finished Skyward Sword. I mean, if the Wii U Zelda is going to be made by Aonuma's team, then it's going to be a while yet to come. So that might be a factor as well. If they really feel like it's important to have a Zelda game early after the Wii U launch, then maybe this has been a long time coming and someone's already like real deep into it.
And they've been very clear about their desire that, you know, it shouldn't take as long as it did for a Wii U exclusive Zelda to appear as it did for a Wii one.
No, but I mean, the fact that Aonuma didn't direct this game, that he produced it, might mean that he could have been stepping out and doing some very preliminary stuff already.
Especially as obviously it seemed like they wanted to hit the 2010 holiday period.
Right.
They missed it, but then pretty much carried it over for the next one. I'm sure it's possible the game could have come out sooner, but they didn't have anything else to fill that
right
slot.
A, it's holiday, and B, it's the year of the 25th anniversary. You better have something.
Is that so? You know, in that time, while they were, I'm sure, still working very significantly on completing the game, maybe it freed up a certain amount to begin the preliminary phases.
Yeah, especially the creative team. I mean, because at that point, they could really step aside.
But I mean, I think what's fascinating to me is really, how do they, you know, at this point, they've tried a number of different things, it seems to me, that are driven at getting Zelda better commercial performance. And they've been focused on accessibility issues. So it seems like their diagnosis of Zelda's limited appeal, perhaps commercially compared to at least something like their really big hits, is that, you know, it's a bit too complicated or it's imposing.
Yeah, I think they're going after the wrong market. If they're trying to expand the audience for Zelda, they should be going after the multi-console, you know, hardcore gamer market. I think those people are far more likely to try Zelda or to come back to Zelda than moms and grandparents are to try it for the first time because they've made it a little bit easier to control.
You gotta walk a delicate line there, though. I mean, what makes games on the multi-console attractive that Zelda doesn't do? And you have to be real careful with what your analysis comes back with.
I'm just saying, make it something that gets gamers excited, like people who already play a lot of games, because a lot of people wrote off Zelda a long time ago. And look, they don't have to make it way more hardcore. Zelda's already one of the most hardcore Nintendo franchises. It's pretty complicated. It's pretty long. I think it's much a matter of marketing and then also bringing Zelda up to the modern standards that people expect out of other games that they see on other systems, you know?
Yeah, especially huge epic games like Zelda proclaims itself to be.
Right. You know, I don't think they have to make it like dark and gritty or something like that.
No.
Just make it feel like a modern game. Make it feel competitive with stuff that people already like to play on other systems. And I think they'll be happy. But most people don't love Zelda as much as we do. Okay. They're happy to play a Zelda game, but they don't want to feel like they have to step back two generations in order to play one. They're not going to do that. But if you make the new Zelda feel like it's just as accessible, it's just as fully featured, it's just as slick of an experience as you get on lots of other RPGs, adventure games, whatever you want on these other systems, then I think people would be happy to play Zelda games. And I think Wii U is a good opportunity for them to go after that because they're going to be on par technically, which they haven't been in quite a while.
I'm tempted, although considering we're on time here, or not on time at all. I'm tempted to press that issue because I'm not sure what specifics you would want to see.
You know, it this will come up again another time, so we can just leave it at that. All right, so that's going to wrap up our listener mail, and we do thank everyone very much for writing in. We don't get time to answer all the emails. As you can tell, a single email can send us darting off into space for quite a while, but we do answer as many as we can, and we do appreciate it. So we hope that you will write to us with your ideas, questions, discussion topics, feedback, and that email address, once again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Again, if you're listening to this in your car and you can't stop and write that down or whatever, just go to the show notes for this episode or any episode over at nintendoworldreport.com, and we will hook you up with a link there where you can send us an email. So before we go, I would like to remind everyone to check out Facebook. And in fact, this is a great segue from our Zelda discussion, because there's a very relevant article that a fan posted on our Facebook page from a writer named Tevis Thompson. I've heard his name. I hadn't read a lot of his stuff before. This guy put a freaking dissertation about his dissatisfaction with the direction of the Zelda series. Has a very different opinion on the franchise than any of us. And I don't agree with a lot of his points, but they are extremely well thought out and extremely well conveyed in this article. And if you're a huge fan of Zelda, if you enjoyed the discussion we just had, you'll probably get a lot out of this. It might make you angry, but I think you'll find it really interesting. So I would recommend you go and check that out. It's over at our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/Radio Free Nintendo. You can like us on there, and you will be immediately notified when new episodes get put up. It's a good place to post photos and artwork and have little discussions and stuff like that. You can also send us feedback on the show through that channel by posting on the wall. We are also on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Metz. That's at JONNYM, as in Mary, ETTS. And James, you are?
I don't remember.
NWR underscore James, even though that could apply to others, it does apply to them.
Because I was first.
And John, you are on Twitter?
Mr. Diamond J, MR Diamond J.
Yeah.
NATO codes, thank you.
Hit us up on there. Greg has too many Twitter accounts to name, so I will occasionally retweet things that his Twitters put up, and so you can follow those too when you find them. And I also want to pimp a few other podcasts. I've got a new episode of my show that I produce and host called Discover Music Project, where we talk about the Beach Boys. It's really cool, so I hope you'll check that out. And there's another show too over at Crosstalk that Zach Miller put up called the Frozen North Dinner Cast, which is it's a neat little show. It's kind of a general topic thing. Him and his buddies get together and over a meal and discuss whatever. Actually, the most recent episode, they play a game of Jeopardy, so it's kind of like the Connectivity Jeopardy, except it's general topics. It could be about anything, but it's good fun to listen to, and you can find both of those over at crosstalk.com, and I would recommend that you do so. And on our Nintendo World Report podcast network, we have a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. That is a podcast about video game music. So if you like game music, this is the podcast that you need to listen to.
And you like trivia.
There is some trivia in there as well, yes. You're guessing the game that the music comes from. But it's a really good show. Michael TYP Cole, our good friend, hosts that show, as he has for many years. And this episode, he's got special guest Pedro Hernandez on there. And Pedro's really fun, too. So check that episode out. It's out right now. That's going to do it for this episode of RFN. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know, and we'll see you next week. Do you think you're going to bring it? Are going to travel with it, like to PAX East?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to bring both.
Yeah, I have the case for it, so it's fine.
But don't you have to pay to check it?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I have to buy a second seat.
Or you could like wrap it in a condom and smuggle it in your ass.
How big is his ass? I know that dog doesn't swallow at all.
Well, he is a big ass, so what? I don't know.
James, full of grace.